extent. Liberalism is hegemony. And liberalism corresponds to the needs and the profits of the Lockheed Martins, of the General Dynamics, of these massive military corporations. That's why you have 100 secret weapon sales. That's why they're trying to push forward $14 billion more for the Israeli General Sebeis, and then for the proxy war, $60 million more, even though it's still been caught up in the House of Representatives. And to be demanding a ceasefire after 154 days of genocide, I mean, this is not an outlandish demand. This is really asking for crumbs. I mean, humanity is asking for the Palestinians to have a place to breathe. Humanity is asking for a Palestinian state and Palestinian self-determination. So the fact that we can't even get ceasefire, even though we have millions of people mobilized across Western Europe, across Africa, across New York City, the entire world is standing up against the U.S. and Israeli axis of genocide and demanding justice. The fact that they are continue to ignore us shows you how unpopular the U.S. government is in the world. And this is going to have a colonial boomerang of violence effect in the upcoming days, months, and years. Who could ever trust the Israelis again, just when the Israelis were thought that they could sit down with the Saudis and with other neighbors? The Israelis have shown just how unneighborly and genocidal they are.
Israel's economy is not doing well. Mukhabir Abu Masada, just to change gears here, and we're looking at a warning to the Prime Minister Netanyahu by the U.S. Treasury Secretary, who told him, listen, you got to make sure that the economy in the West Bank is going to flow, that it's not going to tank. This is pretty interesting, because if it's issuing that warning to Netanyahu, doesn't that mean that if the West Bank falls apart and goes into the direction of the Gaza Strip, which at this point is in crisis levels now with the killings and the abductions, etc., don't you think that that poses an existential threat to Israel when its economy is not doing well and the West Bank economy is teetering on that as well?
Well, what I can tell you about that is that the U.S. is trying to do its best to stabilize the West Bank and to keep also Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, under control. The last thing that the U.S. and Israel would like to see, especially during the month of Ramadan, which is approaching in a few days, is instability in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, which, by the way, Israel is sometimes trying to provoke the Palestinians through its incursions and into West Bank cities like Jenin, Nablus, and other Palestinian cities, trying to provoke the Palestinians into a new intifada or an eruption of violence against Israel. And as I mentioned, that would be the last thing that the U.S. would like to see, in addition to what did to the carnage and the genocide that is taking place in the Gaza Strip. And I think the U.S. has been asking Israel to do two things. One is that Israel has been withholding PA, Palestinian Authority, money, taxes, and revenues right. For the past 5 months. Israel claimed that part of that money goes to the Palestinians in Gaza, right. And even though those Palestinians in Gaza are not members of Hamas, but Israel is trying to punish the Palestinians collectively. And second, there are more than 100,000 Palestinian laborers who are from the West Bank, and since the war erupted, they are no longer working, and that sure. is destabilizing the situation in the West Bank now.
Thank you. We're unfortunately fresh out of time. Thank you, Mukhabir Abu Masada, Professor of Political Science at Al-Azhar University. Daniel Shah, thank you, academic and commentator from New York. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitahue and the team, it's goodbye.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, thank you for joining us. As for today's episode, this is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be your host. And here with me, I have two very dear guests, Sister Bita and Sister Nahid. Well, assalamu alaikum, both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Well, as the ritual of this program goes, I would love you to introduce yourself very much briefly. Like, tell us about your background, what you study, and stuff like that, because we all want to know you.
Salam to you and all your dear listeners. Well, my name is Nahid. I've been studying English translation for about 4 or maybe 5 years. Mm-hmm. And then for my MA, I was studied TFO, I mean teaching English. And yeah, I'm a teacher, Muslim researcher. I've done some researches on my religion as well.
Thank you very much. And
my pleasure.
Yeah, it was a pleasure knowing you. So, and you, Sister Bita?
I'm studying medicine, and it's a pleasure for me to be here with both of you here and our dear listeners out there.
Thank you very much, both of you. Thank you for joining us in today's episode.
Well,
I hope that we're going to have an amazing session together. Well, as you know, as all the human life tells us, like the novels we read, like the stories of great people, like their biography, and there are a lot of movies out there as well, tell us that there are some special moments in each individual's life that would be considered as a revolution. Like, even in our life, we have seen some moments, some eras that are considered to be like the revolutionary part of our lives. Sometimes an incident happens and then I'm not the same me. Like, the same person who was an hour ago is not visible after that 1 hour. Because a moment of manifestation happens, a moment of recognition happens, that I'm starting to see a new version of myself. And not just that, I'm going to see life in a different perspective. As if I have changed the glasses in my eyes, as if unconsciously, without me knowing that, I'm just seeing things differently. So I just want you to talk about this. First of all, tell me.
Yeah,
if
sure.
If you had any of these experiences.
Sure, I had.
So, and then define revolution and that revolution in your perspective to us as well.
Yeah, sure. If I want to talk about myself, I can give you the example of about 10 years ago. I was just about to have the entrance exam. I was 18, and it was that moment in which I just felt the true meaning of revolution in myself. And maybe it is kind of related to the fact that at that age, I confronted death for the first time in my life.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah, not myself, but one of the nearest ones.
I know.
It was my grandpa. I was so attached to him.
Yes.
And at that time that I lost him, it was the kind of bigger revolution in myself. And there I realized that, yeah, a person can change totally. The Nahid, which was just there. An hour ago has just changed now and is another person in another whole new world. And I just found myself loving different things, thinking about different things, and not being scared of the scariest thing in my life, which was death.
And now that's very nice and interesting that you're saying that you started not to be scared of that biggest trauma of your life, which was
exactly.
death. Well, what about you, Sister
Yeah,
Bita?
Contrary to other people that have different experiences of revolution, for example, losing some beloved people, I don't know, going through a kind of religious journey, going through Hajj, and these kind of big accidents of their life that will lead them to the revolution, my story
there
is quite a bit different.
There must be a trigger for that revolution.
Yeah, my story is a bit different. Whenever I go through a phase of loneliness, a phase of solitude, when I go through a phase that I have nothing special to do. For example, it was a phase for me after my university entrance examination, and before going through the university, I had completely nothing to do.
Now, it's very funny that university is, you know, a marker for everyone.
It is.
Yeah, exactly.
It is.
Getting into a new era after you go through that entrance exam.
It's
as
it
if,
always starts from the entrance
examination. As if a new era is going to happen.
And that phase of silence in my life made me a complete revolution at that time, because there was nothing for me to think about, there was nothing for me to do, there was no pressure on me, and that feeling of complete freedom, you know, led me towards the road of being lost.
Exactly.
And that feeling of being lost, you know, was a trigger for me in order to go through a revolutionary phase of my personality. reality.
I do believe in that as yeah. well, because sometimes when I'm left in my brooding zone, I start to understand some things in a different way. And then in that moment, we have the concept of trauma of real. I don't know how much familiar you are with that concept, but psychologically speaking, as according to Lacan, there are different phases of development for a person's psychology. So what happens is that there are three stages. I'm not going to talk about them, but then there's one stage, which is real. And the stage of real, which we do not have any grasp to it, which we do not have any, you know, it's not available to us to understand it. But it happens through momentary experiences that we go through. Like, for example, you're sitting, suddenly you remember something, and suddenly you see something, and then your conscious and unconscious would overlap, and then you get the meaning of that real.
Yeah.
For a moment, you get to touch the realm of real, and then it would create such a trauma of real in you. It's bitter and it's sweet. It's sad and it's happy. All of them together. The revolution that we're talking about just reminded me of that notion, the trauma of real, which is interesting, of course, to go into the depth of it and know more about it. It was just a trigger for you to go and search more and more about it. Well, this is the first step for us to get to know more about revolution. We cut it in here, go for a short break, and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back. Well, this is Back to Reality. We're talking about the revolutionary moment of our lives, and usually it happens with a great incident or accident or phenomenon that happens into our life, like the death of a dear one, like a great exam we go through, like meeting someone, like getting to read a new book. All of these things might lead you to a revolutionary moment that would change you like in a blink of an eye. How do you define those revolutions, by the way?
You know, not psychologically speaking, but I've heard some stuff that when you face the fear and when you kind of cope with it, it is in that moment that you change. And when you change, I guess, in my opinion, a revolution can be defined as a moment in which you totally change. I mean, you can't even recognize your previous person again in your life. And yeah, I think that moment for, at least for myself, it was like this. And when I just coped the phobia, it was there that I changed, and that change just has done a lot of things in myself.
So when you face your traumas and your phobias and you come to embrace them, you think that those moments lead you into a great, they would lead into a great change, and then that would be called a change. So what about you, sister?
I believe there is no combination, like, kind of, for example, revolutionary moments. I mean, revolutions are not moments. Revolutions are process.
They're not moments, but you know, there is a trigger at a specific moment that starts everything. It works like a sparkle.
You know, we as human beings tend to connect our changes to something specific in our life. For example, death of someone. For example,
because they are related.
Yeah, they are related. But when, for example, you meet someone new in your life, at the moment of meeting that person, you don't feel like it will lead you to a revolution.
Trust me, it will.
Sometimes, but not most of the time.
I read a book. Before that book, I have never been thinking about the way that character has thought about.
Okay.
I think about the notion that psychologist is talking about for the first time ever. For a moment, for a short time, like as I told you, just as a trigger, sparkle, a transitory moment.
Yeah.
Like, there comes to happen a moment of a sparkling in my brain.
Yeah, I know.
Like something, like a new light is in my head, and then I start to see things differently.
You know, for me, it's like the moments that my mind goes blank and it's empty.
Yeah.
And this emptiness, after this emptiness, there is a revolution.
Exactly.
But the thing is, I believe most of the revolutions that happen in our life are the times that we don't feel it. We don't think that it's a revolution.
So how but you define it as a revolution?
I define it as the changes and the consequences of the accident that will show itself during a period of time. Mm-hmm. For example, like 1 year, like 2 years.
So you don't necessarily have to be aware of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my point of view about revolution.
Yeah, nice. Very nice. We want to talk about the consequences of these revolutionary moments, but then we have to go for a short break and then come back. Welcome back. Well, this is the last part of today's episode. We're talking about revolutionary moments that happen to all of us, those moments of manifestation, those epiphanic moments that we go through that would make us these new people, like we do not even remember who we were before that. As if I am just thinking outside the box. The previous me is inside that box and I'm no longer in that box anymore. Mm-hmm. If you want to mention some of the most important consequences of the revolutions that you've been through, what are you going to count in that list?
Yeah, if I want to just count them, I'm going to count the new features in me. As I mentioned, the first one surely had been the change in my phobias and in my personality. And in one sentence, I can say I grew up after the revolution. I wasn't just having the previous habits, like acting childish, I don't know, even this. It's a little bit sad, but I used to, as I mentioned, I used to be so attached to my grandfather. And after that, after the revolution in me, after the big change, I realized the maybe true nature of life and how different it could be from the perspective of a teenager, which was just there a few years ago. I just learned how to control my emotions, because there were just some sad moments in which you are just responsible for the people around you.
And you think it's possible to control it?
Not completely. It's not okay, and it's not even possible to stop being attached to people, but it's possible to control.
Yeah, actually, there is this understanding of revolution that it will lead you towards this growth, this being better, and so on. But sometimes, for example, when you lose some beloved people in your life, you feel like life is meaningless. You feel like life is empty. And this feeling of emptiness will lead you towards this carelessness, towards this road that, okay, if it's like that, if I'm going to die one day, why bother myself do this and that? Sometimes revolutions are like that. So the point is, I believe these revolutions are themselves some examinations, mm-hmm. some exams, sometimes obstacles in order to go through for you to understand and to learn how to control different circumstances and different situations in your life.
Yeah, that is very true.
Well, yeah, and I have seen too many people who just fail in those exams.
Exactly.
They can't face.
There are different types of revolutions that might happen to us. Different aspects and different details that are attached to each one of these revolutions. When people go through storms, the person who's going to come out of that storm is not the same as the person who was at the very beginning of that journey. So we're not meant to be and stay the same passive personalities for the rest of our lives. Revolutions happen. We are going to go through growth, or even sometimes maybe those revolutions might be the downfall of us. But the thing which is so important is that the connection to Allah and the connection to your Lord is going to determine what kind of a revolution is going to happen in your life. Sometimes God Himself would bring some incidents, some events that would lead you into revolutions, and those revolutions would create a better version of you. So I hope these moments of manifestation in which the angelic part of you, the most flourished part of you, is going to be apparent, would happen to you and to all of us, actually, generally speaking. I hope it happened to all of us, and Allah help us to flourish ourselves. Thank you for staying with us for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
War on Gaza continues unabated. Israel is pressing ahead with its systematic move to dehumanize the entire population of the Gaza Strip and destroy all aspects of life in the besieged territory. Piles of rubbish and solid waste are now a normal scene in Gaza's streets after Israeli forces targeted all parts of civil life in Gaza, including the municipalities, where dozens of the crews were killed. Waste storages and all related equipment, including waste collection vehicles, were also destroyed in the war and completely paralyzed.
Israeli forces targeted several vehicles used to remove the rubbish, as you can see over there. This left us paralyzed in handling the tremendous amounts of the rubbish left by the displaced people crammed in the central area. We demand that all international bodies help by providing us with the needed equipment and vehicles.
Not only did the deliberate Israeli attacks against the municipalities cause this crisis, but Israeli prevention of delivery of fuel needed to operate the vehicles and equipment worsened the problem. This caused rubbish and wastes to pile up on the streets and in shelters.
This is a big problem we have been suffering from since the beginning of the war on Gaza. The rubbish is scattered everywhere in the vicinity of the hospital, which causes a lot of diseases for people, particularly the children.
Infectious diseases are ravaging Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as the health system collapsed by the war. And dire conditions and scarcity of food and clean water have set off a public health crisis. The Gaza Health Ministry, alongside many international organizations, has called for an end to the catastrophe that is looming in terms of the infectious diseases that began to spread on a wide scale among the displaced Palestinians. Hundreds of thousands of those people, mostly women and children, were now diagnosed with contagious diseases like hepatitis and intestinal diseases.
More than 150 days of this war led to mass displacement of the people who crammed in the evacuation centers without having a real access to the hygiene and cleanness. This caused a lot of infectious diseases, particularly among the children. Needless to mention the severe shortage of the medical supplies and assistance amid the overwhelming number of injuries inflicted by the Israeli attacks.
Months-long incessant Israeli bombardments have put the vast majority of the health facilities out of service. This as limited sanitation facilities and overcrowding shelters are causing the spread of disease and keeping Gaza from recovering.
It's another dark side of the deep catastrophe that still afflicts the Palestinian people as a result of the ongoing apocalyptic Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. While the outcries of the Palestinian civilians are still unanswered and muted by the American veto. the central area of Gaza Strip.
Discussing legal avenues to stop the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Adamant about finding a way to end the catastrophe in Gaza, Iran's Red Crescent Society brought together legal experts from 21 countries in Tehran to attend an international congress on the occupation of Palestine, with a special focus on Israeli violations of international humanitarian law.
Today, what's happening in Gaza is beyond words. Terms such as war crimes are simply not enough to describe what the Zionists are doing. It's been over 5 months, and more than 30,000 people have been killed. The least Muslim countries can do is completely cut off their ties and trade with the Zionists.
A stance that was reiterated by every single speaker of the conference.
Legal experts have been voicing their support for Palestinians. What is happening in Gaza is against everything we know to be the pillars of modern society, violating the Geneva Convention, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and international humanitarian law.
The Universal Declaration of Human Rights and international humanitarian law clearly gives the right to Palestinians. The Israelis are violating the Geneva Convention day in and day out. They should be held accountable for all these crimes in an international tribunal.
We're very clear that the United Nations, the Security Council, at this stance is politicized.
So far, calls to allow food distribution in Gaza have been denied, and there have been numerous warnings against a looming famine. With more than 40,000 online participants from different cities in Iran and around the world, the call for change can be clearly heard.
The participants are demanding accountability. They say today the same countries that wrote the Geneva Convention and the international organizations that claim to be advocates of human rights are silent in the face of Israeli atrocities in Gaza. However, with public opinion shifting against the Israeli regime, this conference could be a first step in creating the kind of change the international community wants to see. Gizum Shahmadi, Tehran.
After days of pause in Yemen's naval operations, the spokesman for the Yemeni army announced the successful targeting of an Israeli ship in the Arabian Sea with multiple missiles. He said that the attack followed the drone and missile strikes against U.S. warships in the Red Sea.
The naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces launched an attack on the Israeli ship MSC Sky sailing in the Arabian Sea with a number of appropriate naval missiles. The missiles hit the vessel in an accurate and direct manner. The operation came only hours after Yemen's armed forces targeted a number of enemy American warships in the Red Sea with a number of ballistic missiles and drones.
Experts say this operation sent some message to the US and UK that Yemen's armed forces are still capable of targeting Israeli-bound vessels in the regional waters. Despite their aggression against Yemen, they believe that the Yemeni army has not used its new weapons yet, which will be another challenge for the Western powers.
Yesterday's operations and the targeting of the Israeli ship and the American warships is a message that the Yemeni armed forces will continue their operations against the enemy. No matter what the Americans do, whether political or military moves, we will continue with our strategic options until the aggression against our brothers in Gaza stops. The Yemeni army will carry out more strikes and still has big surprises for the enemy in the coming days, unless the enemy stops the brutal aggression against Gaza.
On Saturday, the British cargo ship Ruby Mar, which had been targeted by the Yemeni army last month, sank in the Red Sea. The sinking of the Ruby Mar has raised concerns about the potential ecological damage to the Red Sea and its coral reefs, as it was carrying more than 41 tons of fertilizer and had leaked oil for several days after the attack.
Yemeni officials hold the US and UK fully responsible for any pollution resulting from the sinking of the British ship. They assert that Washington is the one militarizing the Red Sea, supporting the Israeli war on Gaza and depriving Palestinians of humanitarian aid, which are the main reasons for Yemeni naval operations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Yeah.
The right to speak out, to protest, the very fabric of democratic rights, once again under attack in the UK, as the government updates its definition of extremism and is about to introduce a potential ban on parliamentarians joining protests. Recommendations from the government's advisor on political violence, John Woodcock, also known as Lord Walney, who is a former chair of Labour Friends of Israel, call on leaders of the mainstream political parties to instruct their MPs to employ a zero-tolerance approach to groups that use disruptive tactics or fail to stop, quote, hate on marches. In the crosshairs, climate activist groups such as Extinction Rebellion and Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who have organized the enormous peaceful mobilizations for Gaza since October last year.
This is an affront to democracy and an indication of a weak and decaying government's descent into authoritarianism. It's totally out of touch with the British people and actually very much out of keeping with the British values that they claim to champion.
Ahead of Walney's recommendations, and after the by-election in Rochdale, Greater Manchester, that handed pro-Palestine campaigner George Galloway a thumping victory, a speech by the Prime Minister vilifying the pro-Palestinian protests demanding a ceasefire in Gaza.
In recent weeks and months, we have seen a shocking increase in extremist disruption and criminality. What started as protests on our street has descended into intimidation, threats, and planned acts of violence.
Critics say comments like those about peaceful demonstrations are a threat to the long tradition of freedom of protest and expression in the country.
His assertions are totally false. I mean, you know, the claims of an increase in anti-Semitism, of extremism, there is no evidence for that. I mean, this is just pure invention and another indication, frankly, of how weak this government really is. To have a special address to the nation as if there was some sort of state of emergency. Some people that spoke to me thought that we'd declared war on Russia. What it was George Galloway, the leader of the Workers' Party, getting elected as a Member of Parliament. I mean, that should be celebrated, not attacked in that way. It's just absolutely ridiculous.
The new changes are yet to be announced and legislated, but the political temperature is rapidly rising in the UK.
In its 2024 World Report, Human Rights Watch says that the UK government's practices and policies have severely curtailed domestic human rights protections. Others say the country is at risk of turning into a police state masquerading as a democracy. The question now is, how deep will those erosions go? And will the MPs in the building behind me allow them to continue? Saeed Pourreza, London.
Iran has held a final round of a national moot court to stimulate taking proceedings against enforcers of unilateral sanctions and those who comply with them. The session was held by Iran's Institute of Judiciary in cooperation with the country's High Council for Human Rights in Tehran. Speaking at the event, the secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, said that sanctions were considered weapons of war and even more destructive than a war due to their substantial impacts and being a collective punishment against a targeted country's people.
Undeniable rights cannot be ignored in sanctions, and implementing global peace and security cannot be possible without taking such rights into consideration. The legality of the legitimacy of sanctions is an important issue that the Security Council must consider in the discussion of imposing sanctions. Meanwhile, the international community has not yet accepted the legitimacy of unilateral sanctions.
Elena Duhan, UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, also delivered a speech at the session via video conference.
In the situation of Iran, the most absurd cases refer to the impossibility to deliver bandages for EB patients from the only monopolist producer in Sweden, and similarly impossibility to deliver the medicine necessary for thalassemia patients suffering from some sort of autist state, as well as some sort of psychological and physical diseases, especially if we are talking about the rare ones or the most severe ones. As a result, these are patients which are not directly designated by any type of sanctions, which are deprived of any possibility of access to health care system.
Meanwhile, speaking at the session, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri-Kani said sanctions were the biggest crimes against humanity and were a collective punishment and proof that those who pursue and promote unilateralism do not respect human rights.
Iran is among the countries under the U.S. cruel sanctions, which is making efforts to restore the country's rights as a national duty. Sanctions arise from the international behavior and phenomena, and they disturb the future security and stability of the world. For a country which imposes sanctions, international law or human rights are not important.
Iran has been under U.S. sanctions for the past 4 decades. The sanctions intensified following the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from a 2015 nuclear deal in May 2018, formerly known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
Iranian authorities have repeatedly blamed the U.S. sanctions for shortage of medicines that treat special diseases like cancer. Health officials have warned that the harm caused by U.S. sanctions on Iran's access to pharmaceutical supplies may even get worse in the future. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed the readiness of the Lebanese resistance to face any possible Israeli aggression against Lebanon. He said any Israeli act of aggression would trigger an advanced version of the 2006 war, when the Tel Aviv regime suffered a humiliating defeat at the hands of Hezbollah.
The Zionist enemy continues to threaten us with military aggression. We respond by means of steadfastness, resistance, and retaliatory strikes. We hereby declare that if they commit a foolish act and attack our territories, there would then be a new version of the July 2006 war.
He warned Israelis that Hezbollah would fight in an even more sophisticated manner in any future confrontation, stressing that the outcome will eventually be a victory for the resistance fighters. Sheikh Qasem was speaking at the 6th International Conference for the Union of Resistance Scholars in Lebanon's capital, Beirut. Representatives of the Palestinian resistance factions also stressed that the United States' all-out support for the Israeli warmongering policies has given a cover to the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities as its genocidal Gaza war has marked 150 days. Hamas official Osama Hamdan stressed that Muslim nations are duty-bound to foil U.S.-Israeli plots against war-torn Gaza.
It is the duty of Arabs and Muslims worldwide to take the initiative and foil Israel's conspiracy of starvation. The countries neighboring the Gaza Strip must not stand idly by and should take a concrete measure, especially for Gazans in the north.
Scholars and thinkers from diverse Muslim countries have come together to voice their support for the Palestinian people and the resistance. They sent a message of solidarity for Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as Israel's unbridled and unfazed brutality continues unabated.
50 scholars, top scholars from 25 countries, they are gathered here, and hopefully they will reach to any kind of the solution, kind of support and solidarity for the people.
The Palestinians are sending a very strong message. That look, you be answerable to this. You know, the accountability is not only in Israel who are the murderers, but accountability should also be there among the Muslims. Why are you not doing anything? So that's why Palestinians are giving that voice. They are struggling, they are saying they're going to fight to the end, and therefore they say, if you want to help, it's your responsibility, it's not we appealing.
With the Israeli regime's genocidal war in Gaza now in its 5th month and over 30,000 civilian fatalities, scholars in Beirut assert that the resistance in the region has no choice but to continue its armed struggle until the final victory.
The Muslim clerics in support of the resistance have stressed through their discussions and meetings here in Beirut that the Palestinian cause is a reason for unity and solidarity. They say the teachings of the Quran have drawn a roadmap for supporting the Palestinian people in their struggle to free a land considered holy to all Muslims. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A series of restrictions were imposed on the Yemeni economy following the U.S. redesignation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group earlier this year. This blacklisting has had an impact on the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country, where millions of people are in dire need of aid.
Ansarullah, as a political component, has no external economic relations or companies in the private sector that have real weight in the national economy. The real goal of the resolution is to blackmail Ansarullah and distort their position in support of Gaza. The Yemeni economy has been in a state of siege for 9 years, and therefore, the American measures putting pressure on the local economy, we believe, will not have much effect, especially since the Yemeni economy has withstood pressure over the past years and adapted to the measures imposed by the exiled Yemeni government in Riyadh. The Central Bank of Yemen will also work to impose procedures to secure the transfer of foreign exchange to and from Yemen.
Several international companies, including the money transfer company Western Union, have suspended their activities in Yemen, severely affecting the livelihoods of most Yemenis who rely on financial support from relatives abroad. Experts predict that such actions will lead to the creation of a black market for those benefiting from the suspension of money transfers.
The United States of America imposed collective punishment on the Yemeni people. Very important financial channels were stopped, such as Western Union, which is one of the most important money transfer networks in the world. And through it, Yemeni expatriates in American and European countries used to send money to their families in Yemen easily. We have 6 million expatriates outside the country and thousands of Yemeni families depend on them to provide a living. You can imagine what the situation will become after these financial transfers stop. The beneficiaries of this measure are black market workers who exploit these circumstances by deducing a percentage of their remittances and transfer them through illegal channels.
In an effort to deter Yemen's naval operations against vessels linked to the United States, the United Kingdom, and Israel in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, the U.S. Department of State blacklisted the Ansarullah movement as a specially designated global terrorist group. However, this designation has primarily affected the humanitarian situation, as members of the Ansarullah movement have no investments abroad.
Observers believe that Washington's recent measures are aimed at inciting the Yemeni people to take to the streets in opposition to the Ansarullah movement as a strategic move to undermine the group's popularity in the country. But that plot does not look like it will succeed, given the widespread support for Ansarullah in Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In the limelight.
The co-founders of the Truth Social platform are suing Donald Trump, claiming that Trump tried to dilute their shares. A lawyer representing the co-founders of Truth Social said, "They created Truth Social and now the beneficiary of that, Donald Trump, doesn't want to pay." We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Huffington Post has covered this story and tells us more. An estimated $4 billion business merger involving former President Donald Trump's social media company could hit a major snarl after a lawsuit was filed on Wednesday, 28th of February, accusing Donald Trump of trying to dilute the co-founder's shares. Andy Lutinsky and Wes Moss, who co-founded Trump's Truth Social platform, filed a lawsuit in Delaware, claiming their previously negotiated 8.6% stake in Trump Media and Technology Group has been watered down to less than 1%, the Washington Post and CNBC have reported. The dispute comes as the Trump Media and Technology Group eyes a merger with the publicly traded shell company Digital World Acquisition Corp. The sale, which Digital World's shareholders are scheduled to vote on next month, is estimated to be worth as much as $4 billion. According to the New York Times. The attempt here is to deprive them of the deal, attorney Christopher Clark, who is representing Andy Latinsky, and Wes Moss, partnership United Atlantic Ventures, in the complaint, told CNBC News. They actually went out and did the work. They created the Truth Social platform, and now the beneficiary of that, Donald Trump, doesn't want to pay. Christopher Clark and representatives of Donald Trump, Digital World, and the Trump Media and Technology Group did not immediately respond to Huffington Post requests for comment. Under the United Atlantic Ventures previously reached agreement, Donald Trump would receive 78 million shares that are worth about $3.5 billion at today's share price value. United Atlantic Ventures would receive more than 7 million shares, equating to roughly $339 million, according to the Washington Post review of a court motion requesting expedited proceedings in the case. Digital World appeared to recognize that previous deal with United Atlantic Ventures in a Securities and Exchange Commission filing early this month, but said that the agreement was declared void by a Trump attorney more than 2 years ago. The sale of any stock could come as a major financial lifeline to Donald Trump, who has faced numerous legal judgments against him since leaving Oval Office, including an order earlier this month to pay $355 million plus interest for committing business fraud in New York State. An appeals court judge on Wednesday denied Trump's request to pause that judgment's enforcement. Trump, currently the frontrunner for the Republican presidential nomination, argued that he doesn't have the cash to cover the penalty. This isn't the first time that a founder of Trump's Truth Social platform has spoken out against him while alleging misconduct, particularly involving stocks. Will Wilkerson, who helped found the Trump Media and Technology Group, but was then fired after speaking out about alleged security law violations, alleged in 2022 that Donald Trump asked Andy Latinsky to relinquish his stock in the company to his wife, Melania Trump. Will Wilkerson also said that Trump's sons, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump, requested a financial stake in the social media platform despite having never worked for the company. They were coming in and asking for a handout, Wilkerson told the Washington Post. They had no bearing in this company, and they were taking equity away from hardworking individuals. National broadcaster CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump was accused in a lawsuit on Wednesday, 28th of February, of trying to drastically dilute the value of stock shares in his social media company, held by the firm's co-founders, potentially depriving them of hundreds of millions of dollars in profits. The partnership United Atlantic Ventures alleges that Donald Trump's media and technology group engaged in wrongful 11th-hour maneuvering to dilute United Atlantic Ventures' minority stake in the media company, according to a court filing. The Delaware Chancery Court lawsuit comes in advance of the planned merger of TMTG, the Trump Media and Technology Group, with a shell company called Digital World Acquisition Corp., which would result in the shares of the combined entity being publicly traded. If the Digital World Acquisition Corp. shareholders approve the merger next month, Trump's 90% stake in the Trump Media and Technology Group could be valued at more than $3 billion, given the Digital World Acquisition Corp.'s current share price. On Thursday, an investment vehicle controlled by former Digital World Acquisition Corp. chairman and chief executive officer Patrick Orlando sued in Chancery Court to block the merger unless it receives a larger number of shares from the combination that Digital World Acquisition Corp. proposes, according to a Reuters news agency report. The news service noted that the Trump Media and Technology Group and the Digital World Acquisition Corp. on Tuesday sued Orlando and his ARK Global Investments II vehicle in Florida, claiming that he's trying to obtain a windfall by extortion. United Atlantic Ventures is a partnership of Andy Litinsky and Wes Moss, who initially pitched Trump the idea of creating Trump Media in February of 2021, after the former president was banned from Twitter and Facebook following the deadly 6th of January 2021 Capitol riot. Both Andy Litinsky and Wes Moss were contestants on Trump's television show, The Apprentice. The Trump Media and Technology Group later built and launched Truth Social, the social media platform that Donald Trump uses almost exclusively to communicate with the public. The planned merger comes as Trump, who is leading candidate for the Republican presidential nomination, has been ordered to pay more than $500 million in civil judgments in New York related to trial verdicts for business fraud and the defamation of writer E. Jean Carroll. The attempt here is to deprive them of the deal, said Christopher Clark, the lawyer for United Atlantic Ventures in the partnership's Delaware lawsuit against the Trump Media and Technology Group. It's not like they went out and bought a lottery ticket, Clark said of the co-founders. They actually went out and did the work. They created the Truth Social platform, and now the beneficiary of that, Donald Trump, doesn't want to pay. Not a unique story, unfortunately, Christopher Clark said, referring to Trump's infamous practice of contesting bills from contractors and lawyers. CNBC has requested comment from a spokesperson for Donald Trump. CNBC has requested comment from a spokesman for Donald Trump, as well as the Trump Media and Technology Group.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant fact.
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
مهدی نراقی
کتابی نوشت به نام جامع السعادات، یک کتاب اخلاقی بسیار ارزنده.
The late Mullah Mahdi Naraqi compiled a book titled جامع السعادات. This book is about Islamic morality and ethics. Once Mullah Mahdi, in order to pay ziyarah, went to Atabat and the city of Najaf. When he resided in his house in Najaf, many of the scholars and students went to his house to see him. The news reached the late Sayyid Mahdi Bahrul Ulum, who was a great scholar on that time, living in the city of Najaf. The late Sayyid did not go to visit the late Mullah. The late Mullah Naraqi started to visit back the scholars.
اطرافیانش گفت امروز میریم خونه بحرالعلوم، میریم خونه سید بحرالعلوم.
The late Naraqi told his students to get prepared to go and visit the late Sayyid Bahrululum. The students told the late Mullah Naraqi that Sayyid Bahrululum did not come to visit you. So why are you going to visit him? The late Mullah Naraqi stated, Sayyid Bahrululum is a master and we must respect him. Anyway, they went to visit Sayyid Bahrululum, but since it was the first time meeting between the two, the late Sayyid didn't recognize the late Mullah Naraqi and welcomed him in a normal and regular way. The late Mullah Naraqi didn't get angry and sat down for a short time and left. In this way, Sayyid Bahrul Ulum wanted to test the late Mullah Naraqi's reaction to see whether he observes the ethical etiquettes he taught and he compiled in his book, Jamu Saadat, or not. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam Pesh, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.ir Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Face to face. Hello and welcome to another edition of Face to Face. I'm Mahdi Abbasian. Today in the studio, we are joined by one of the members of the political bureau of the Hamas resistance movement, Mr. Osama Hamdan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Hamdan, the Al-Aqsa flood was a powerful, unexpected blow to the Israeli occupation. But did you anticipate the Israeli response to be this much brutal and heinous?
There is no doubt that Operation Al-Aqsa Flood represented a success for the resistance movement, a success in carrying out a large-scale operation without the enemy being able to take action preemptively. This operation succeeded in seizing the entire Gaza positions within just hours. This is undoubtedly a great achievement, but here's the question. Was there any expectation for the enemy's reaction? Certainly. It was expected that there would be a reaction, but it is the nature of the occupation. It kills you, seizes your land, arrests you, and imprisons you. For example, in the West Bank in 2022, before the operations, the number of martyrs was about 500. The number of wounded people who were taken to hospitals exceeded 3,000. We are talking about thousands of prisoners. Under this occupation for 75 years, you have two